for months, and would not be in the embarrassing position of seeing his comrade fighting and himself limited to making demonstrations. He wanted to do something more, and he was not now in a position to do it. The Nazi warlord had no intention of postponing his attack in the West, and said so, but he had a few theoretical ideas which might solve Mussolini's difficulty of making a frontal attack on mountainous southern France, since that conflict, he realized, would cost a great deal of blood. Why not, he suggested, supply a strong Italian force which, together with German troops, would advance along the Swiss frontier toward the Rhone Valley, in order to turn the Franco-Italian Alpine front from the rear? Before this, of course, the main German armies would have rolled back the French and British in the north. Hitler was obviously trying to make it easy for the Italians. When the enemy has been smashed, in northern France, the moment would come, Hitler continued, for Italy to intervene actively, not at the most difficult point on the Alpine front, but elsewhere. The war will be decided in France. Once France is disposed of, Italy will be mistress of the Mediterranean, and England will have to make peace. Mussolini, it must be said, was not slow at seizing upon this glittering prospect of getting so much after the Germans had done all the hard fighting. The Duce replied that once Germany had made a victorious advance, he would intervene immediately. He would lose no time, when the Allies were so shaken by the German attack that it needed only a second blow to bring them to their knees. On the other hand, if Germany's progress was slowed, the Duce said that then he would wait. This crude, cowardly bargain seems not to have unduly bothered Hitler. If Mussolini was personally attracted to him, as Ciano said, by something deeply rooted in his makeup, it might be said that the attraction was mutual, for the same mysterious reasons. Disloyal as he had been to some of his closest associates, a number of whom he had had murdered, such as Röhm and Strasser, Hitler maintained a strange and unusual loyalty to his ridiculous Italian partner that did not weaken, that indeed was strengthened when adversity and then disaster overtook the strutting sawdust Roman Caesar. It is one of the interesting paradoxes of this narrative. At any rate, for what it was worth, and few Germans besides Hitler, especially among the generals, thought it was worth very much, Italy's entrance into the war had now at last been solemnly promised. The Nazi warlord could turn his thoughts again to new and imminent conquests. Of the most imminent one, in the north, he did not breathe a word to his friend and ally. The conspirators again frustrated. Once more, the anti-Nazi plotters tried to persuade the generals to depose the leader, this time before he could launch his new aggression in the north, of which they had got wind. What the civilian conspirators again wanted was assurance from the British government that it would make peace with an anti-Nazi German regime, and, being what they were insistent that in any settlement the new Reich government be allowed to keep most of Hitler's territorial gains, Austria, the Sudetenland, and the 1914 frontier in Poland, though this last had only been obtained in the past by the wiping out of the Polish nation. It was with such a proposal that Hassel, with considerable personal courage, journeyed to Arosa, Switzerland, on February 21, 1940, to confer with a British contact whom he calls Mr. X in his diary, and who was a certain J. Lonsdale Bryans. They conferred in the greatest secrecy at four meetings on February 22nd and 23rd. Bryans, who had cut a certain figure in the Diplomatic Society of Rome, was another of those self-appointed and somewhat amateurish negotiators for peace who have turned up in this narrative. He had contacts in Downing Street, and Hassel, once they had met, was personally impressed by him. After the fiasco of the attempt of Major Stevens and Captain Best in Holland to get in touch with the German conspirators, the British were somewhat skeptical of the whole business, and when Bryans pressed Hassel for some reliable information as to whom he was speaking for, the German envoy became cagey. "I am not in a position to name the men who are backing me," Hassel retorted. "I can only assure you that a statement from Halifax would get to the right people." Hassel then outlined the views of the German opposition. It was realized that Hitler had to be overthrown before major military operations are undertaken, that this must be an exclusively German affair, that there must be some authoritative English statement about how a new anti-Nazi regime in Berlin would be treated, and that the principal obstacle to any change in regime is the story of 1918, that is, German anxiety lest things develop as they did then, after the Kaiser was sacrificed. Hassel and his friends wanted guarantees that if they got rid of Hitler, Germany would be treated more generously than it was after the Germans had got rid of Wilhelm II. He thereupon handed over to Bryans a memorandum which he himself had drawn up in English. It is a woolly document, though full of noble sentiments about a future world based on the principles of Christian ethics, justice and law, social welfare, and liberty of thought and conscience. The greatest danger of continuing this mad war, Hassel wrote, was a Bolshevization of Europe. He considered that worse than the continuance of Nazism. And his main condition for peace was that the new Germany be left with almost all of Hitler's conquests, which he enumerated. The German acquisition of Austria and the Sudetenland could not even be discussed in any proposed peace, and Germany would have to have the 1914 frontier with Poland, which, of course, though he did not say so, was actually the 1914 frontier with Russia, since Poland had not been allowed to exist in 1914. Bryans agreed that speedy action was necessary in view of the imminence of the German offensive in the West, and promised to deliver Hassel's memorandum to Lord Halifax. Hassel returned to Berlin to acquaint his fellow plotters with his latest move. Although they hoped for the best from Hassel's Mr. X, they were more concerned at the moment with the so-called X report, which Hans von Dohnányi, one of the members of the group in the Abwehr, had drawn up on the basis of Dr. Müller's contact with the British at the Vatican. It declared that the Pope was ready to intervene with Britain for reasonable peace terms with a new anti-Nazi German government, and it is a measure of the views of these opponents of Hitler that one of their terms, which they claimed the Holy Father would back, was the settlement of the Eastern question in favor of Germany. The demonic Nazi dictator had obtained a settlement in the East in favor of Germany by armed aggression. The good German conspirators wanted the same thing handed to them by the British with the Pope's blessings. The X report loomed very large in the minds of the plotters that winter of 1939-40. At the end of October, General Tomas had shown it to Brauchitsch with the intention of bucking up the army commander-in-chief in his efforts to dissuade Hitler from launching the offensive in the West that fall. But Brauchitsch did not appreciate such encouragement. In fact, he threatened to have General Tomas arrested if he brought the matter up again. It was plain high treason, he barked at him. Now, with a fresh Nazi aggression in the offing, Tomas took the X report to General Halder in the hope that he might act on it. But this was a vain hope. As the general staff chief told Gerdler, one of the most active of the conspirators, who had also begged him to take the lead since the spineless Brauchitsch would not, he could not at this time justify breaking his oath as a soldier to the Führer. Besides, England and France had declared war on us, and one had to see it through. A peace of compromise was senseless. Only in the greatest emergency could one take the action desired by Gerdler. "Also doch," exclaimed Hassel in his diary on April 6, 1940, in recounting Halder's state of mind as explained to him by Gerdler. Halder, the diarist added, who had begun to weep during the discussion of his responsibility, gave the impression of a weak man with shattered nerves. The accuracy of such an impression is to be doubted. When one goes over Halder's diary for the first week of April, cluttered as it is with hundreds of detailed entries about preparations for the gigantic offensive in the West, which he was helping to mastermind, this writer, at least, gets the impression that the general staff chief was in a buoyant mood as he conferred with the field commanders and checked the final plans for the greatest and most daring military operation in German history. There is no hint in his journal of treasonable thoughts or of any wrestling with his conscience. Though he has misgivings about the attack on Denmark and Norway, they are based purely on military grounds, and there is not a word of moral doubt about Nazi aggression against the four small neutral countries whose frontiers Germany had solemnly guaranteed, and whom Halder knew Germany was about to attack, and against two of whom, Belgium and Holland, he himself had taken a leading part in drafting the plans. So ended the latest attempt of the good Germans to oust Hitler before it was too late. It was the last opportunity they would have to obtain a generous peace. The generals, as Brauchitsch and Halder had made clear, were not interested in a negotiated peace. They were thinking now, as was the Führer, of a dictated peace, dictated after German victory. Not until the chances of that had gone glimmering did they seriously return to their old and treasonable thoughts, which had been so strong at Munich and at Zossen, of removing their mad dictator. This state of mind and character must be remembered in view of subsequent events and of subsequent spinning of myths. The Taking of Denmark and Norway. Hitler's preparations for the conquest of Denmark and Norway have been called by many writers one of the best-kept secrets of the war. But it has seemed to this author that the two Scandinavian countries and even the British were caught napping not because they were not warned of what was coming, but because they did not believe the warnings in time. 10 days before disaster struck, Colonel Oster of the Abwehr warned a close friend of his, Colonel J.G. Sass, the Dutch military attaché in Berlin, of the German plans for Weserübung, and Sass immediately informed the Danish naval attaché, Captain Kjølsen. But the complacent Danish government would not believe its own naval attaché, and when on April 4th the Danish minister in Berlin sent Kjølsen scurrying to Copenhagen to repeat the warning in person, his intelligence was still not taken seriously. Even on the eve of catastrophe, on the evening of March 8th, after news had been received of the torpedoing of a German transport laden with troops off the south coast of Norway, just north of Denmark, and the Danes had seen with their own eyes a great German naval armada sailing north between their islands, the King of Denmark had dismissed with a smile a remark at the dinner table that his country was in danger. He really didn't believe that, the guards officer who was present later reported. In fact, this officer related, the king had proceeded after dinner to the Royal Theatre in a confident and happy frame of mind. Already in March, the Norwegian government had received warnings from its legation in Berlin and from the Swedes about a German concentration of troops and naval vessels in the North Sea and Baltic ports. And on April 5th, definite intelligence arrived from Berlin of imminent German landings on the southern coast of Norway. But the complacent cabinet in Oslo remained skeptical. Not even on the 7th, when several large German war vessels were sighted proceeding up the Norwegian coast, and reports arrived of British planes strafing a German battle fleet off the mouth of the Skagerrak. Not even on April 8th, when the British Admiralty informed the legation of Norway in London that a strong German naval force had been discovered approaching Narvik, and the newspapers in Oslo were reporting that German soldiers rescued from the transport Rio de Janeiro, torpedoed that day off the Norwegian coast at Lillesand by a Polish submarine, had declared they were en route to Bergen to help defend it against the British. Not even then did the Norwegian government consider it necessary to take such obvious steps as mobilizing the army, fully manning the forts guarding the harbors, blocking the airfield runways, or, most important of all, mining the easily mined, narrow water approaches to the capital and the main cities. Had it done these things, history might have taken a different turning. Ominous news, as Churchill puts it, had begun filtering into London by the 1st of April, and on April 3rd, the British War Cabinet discussed the latest intelligence, above all from Stockholm, which told of the Germans collecting sizable military forces in its northern ports with the objective of moving into Scandinavia. But the news does not seem to have been taken very seriously. 2 days later, on April 5th, when the first wave of German naval supply ships was already at sea, Prime Minister Chamberlain proclaimed in a speech that Hitler, by failing to attack in the west when the British and French were unprepared, had missed the bus, a phrase he was very shortly to rue. The first three German supply ships had sailed for Narvik at 2 a.m. on April 3rd. Germany's largest tanker left Murmansk for Narvik on April 6th, with the connivance of the Russians, who obligingly furnished the cargo of oil. The British government at this moment, according to Churchill, was inclined to believe that the German build-up in the Baltic and North Sea ports was being done merely to enable Hitler to deliver a counterstroke in case the British, in mining Norwegian waters to cut off the ore shipments from Narvik, also occupied that port and perhaps others to the south. As a matter of fact, the British government was contemplating such an occupation. After 7 months of frustration, Churchill, First Lord of the Admiralty, had finally succeeded in getting the approval of the War Cabinet and the Allied Supreme War Council to mine the Norwegian leads on April 8th, an action called Wilfred. Since it seemed likely that the Germans would react violently to the mortal blow of having their iron ore shipments from Narvik blocked, it was decided that a small Anglo-French force should be dispatched to Narvik and advance to the nearby Swedish frontier. Other contingents would be landed at Trondheim, Bergen, and Stavanger, farther south, in order, as Churchill explained, to deny these bases to the enemy. This was known as Plan R4. Thus, during the first week of April, while German troops were being loaded on various warships for the passage to Norway, British troops, though in much fewer numbers, were being embarked on transports in the Clyde and on cruisers in the Forth for the same destination. On the afternoon of April 2nd, Hitler, after a long conference with Göring, Raeder, and Falkenhorst, issued a formal directive ordering Weserübung to begin at 5:15 a.m. on April 9th. At the same time, he issued another directive stipulating that the escape of the kings of Denmark and Norway from their countries at the time of the occupation must be prevented by all means. Also, on the same day, OKW let the Foreign Office in on the secret. A lengthy directive was presented to Ribbentrop, instructing him to prepare the diplomatic measures for inducing Denmark and Norway to surrender without a fight as soon as the German armed forces had arrived, and to concoct some kind of justification for Hitler's latest aggression. But trickery was not to be confined to the Foreign Office. The Navy was also to make use of it. On April 3rd, with the departure of the first vessels, Jodl reflected in his diary on the problem of how deceit could be used to hoodwink the Norwegians in case they became suspicious of the presence of so many German men of war in their vicinity. Actually, this little matter had already been worked out by the Navy. It had instructed its warships and transports to try to pass as British craft, even if it were necessary to fly the Union Jack. Secret German naval commands laid down detailed orders for deception and camouflage in the invasion of Norway. Most secret. Behavior during entrance into the harbor. All ships darkened. The disguise as British craft must be kept as long as possible. All challenges in Morse by Norwegian ships will be answered in English. In answer, something like the following will be chosen. Calling at Bergen for a short visit. No hostile intent. Challenges to be answered with names of British warships. Köln, HMS Cairo. Königsberg, HMS Calcutta, etc. Arrangements are to be made to enable British war flags to be illuminated. For Bergen, following is laid down as guiding principle should one of our own units find itself compelled to answer the challenge of passing craft. To challenge, in case of the Köln, HMS Cairo. To order to stop, 1. Please repeat last signal. 2. Impossible to understand your signal. In case of a warning shot, stop firing, British ship, good friend. In case of an inquiry as to destination and purpose, going Bergen, chasing German steamers. On the stand at Nuremberg, Grand Admiral Raeder justified such tactics on the ground that they were a legitimate ruse of war against which, from the legal point of view, no objection can be made. And so, on April 9th, 1940, at 5:20 a.m. precisely, 4:20 a.m. in Denmark, an hour before dawn, the German envoys at Copenhagen and Oslo, having routed the respective foreign ministers out of bed exactly 20 minutes before, Ribbentrop had insisted on a strict timetable in coordination with the arrival at that hour of the German troops, presented to the Danish and Norwegian governments a German ultimatum demanding that they accept on the instant and without resistance the protection of the Reich. The ultimatum was perhaps the most brazen document yet composed by Hitler and Ribbentrop, who were such masters and by now so experienced in diplomatic deceit. After declaring that the Reich had come to the aid of Denmark and Norway to protect them against an Anglo-French occupation, the memorandum stated, "The German troops, therefore, do not set foot on Norwegian soil as enemies. The German High Command does not intend to make use of the points occupied by German troops as bases for operations against England, as long as it is not forced to. On the contrary, German military operations aim exclusively at protecting the North against the proposed occupation of Norwegian bases by Anglo-French forces. In the spirit of the good relations between Germany and Norway which have existed hitherto, the Reich government declares to the Royal Norwegian government that Germany has no intention of infringing by her measures the territorial integrity and political independence of the Kingdom of Norway now or in the future. The Reich government therefore expects that the Norwegian government and the Norwegian people will offer no resistance to it. Any resistance would have to be, and would be, broken by all possible means, and would therefore lead only to absolutely useless bloodshed. German expectations proved justified as regards Denmark, but not Norway. This became known in the Wilhelmstrasse with the receipt of the first urgent messages from the respective ministers to those countries. The German envoy in Copenhagen wired Ribbentrop at 8:34 a.m. that the Danes had accepted all our demands, though registering a protest. Minister Kurt Breuer in Oslo had a quite different report to make. At 5:52 a.m., just 32 minutes after he had delivered the German ultimatum, he wired Berlin the quick response of the Norwegian government. "We will not submit voluntarily. The struggle is already underway." The arrogant Ribbentrop was outraged. This writer had rarely seen the Nazi foreign minister more insufferable than he was that morning. He strutted into a specially convoked press conference at the Foreign Office, garbed in a flashy field-gray uniform and looking, I noted in my diary, as if he owned the earth. He snapped, "The Führer has given his answer. Germany has occupied Danish and Norwegian soil in order to protect those countries from the Allies, and will defend their true neutrality until the end of the war. Thus an honored part of Europe has been saved from certain downfall." The Berlin press was also something to see that day. The Bursen Zeitung: "England goes cold-bloodedly over the dead bodies of small peoples. Germany protects the weak states from the English highway robbers. Norway ought to see the righteousness of Germany's action, which was taken to ensure the freedom of the Norwegian people." Hitler's own paper, the Fuchsischer Beobachter, carried this banner line: "Germany saves Scandinavia." At 10:55, Ribbentrop wired Breuer, "Most urgent. You will once more impress on the government there that Norwegian resistance is completely senseless." This the unhappy German envoy could no longer do. The Norwegian king, government, and members of parliament had by this time fled the capital for the mountains in the north. However hopeless the odds, they were determined to resist. In fact, resistance had already begun in some places, though not in all, with the arrival of German ships out of the night. The Danes were in a more hopeless position. Their pleasant little island country was incapable of defense. It was too small, too flat, and the largest part, Jutland, lay open by land to Hitler's panzers. There were no mountains for the king and the government to flee to as there were in Norway, nor could any help be expected from Britain. It has been said that the Danes were too civilized to fight in such circumstances. At any rate, they did not. General W. W. Pryor, the army commander-in-chief, almost alone pleaded for resistance, but he was overruled by Premier Thorvald Stauning, Foreign Minister Edvard Munch, and the king, who, when the bad news began coming in on April 8th, refused his pleas for mobilization. For reasons which remain obscure to this writer, even after an investigation in Copenhagen, the Navy never fired a shot, either from its ships or from its shore batteries, even when German troop ships passed under the noses of its guns and could have been blown to bits. The Army fought a few skirmishes in Jutland, the Royal Guard fired a few shots around the Royal Palace in the capital and suffered a few men wounded. By the time the Danes had finished their hearty breakfasts, it was all over. The king, on the advice of his government, but against that of General Pryor, capitulated and ordered what slight resistance there was to cease. The plans to take Denmark by surprise and deceit, as the captured German army records show, had been prepared with meticulous care. General Kurt Himmer, chief of staff of the task force for Denmark, had arrived by train in civilian clothes in Copenhagen on April 7th to reconnoiter the capital and make the necessary arrangements for a suitable pier to dock the troop ship Hansestadt Danzig, and a truck to handle the moving of a few supplies and a radio transmitter. The commander of the battalion, all that was considered necessary to capture a great city, had also been in Copenhagen in civilian clothes a couple of days before to get the layout of the land. It was not so strange, therefore, that the plans of the general and the battalion major were carried out with scarcely a hitch. The troopship arrived off Copenhagen shortly before dawn, passed without challenge the guns of the fort guarding the harbor and those of the Danish patrol vessels, and tied up neatly at the Langelinie pier in the heart of the city, only a stone's throw from the citadel, the headquarters of the Danish army, and but a short distance from Amalienborg Palace, where the king resided. Both were quickly seized by the lone battalion with no resistance worth mentioning. Upstairs in the palace, amidst the rattle of scattered shots, the king conferred with his ministers. The latter were all for non-resistance. Only General Pryor begged to be allowed to put up a fight. At the very least, he demanded that the king should leave for the nearest military camp at Hulvita to escape capture. But the king agreed with his ministers. The monarch, according to one eyewitness, asked whether our soldiers had fought long enough, and Pryor retorted that they had not. Total Danish casualties throughout the realm were 13 killed and 23 wounded. The Germans suffered some 20 casualties. General Himer became restless at the delay. He telephoned headquarters for the combined operation, which had been set up at Hamburg. The Danish authorities had not thought of cutting the telephone lines to Germany, and according to his own story, asked for some bombers to zoom over Copenhagen in order to force the Danes to accept. The conversation was in code, and the Luftwaffe understood that Himer was calling for an actual bombing, which it promised to carry out forthwith, an error which was finally corrected just in time. General Himer says the bombers roaring over the Danish capital did not fail to make their impression. The government accepted the German requests. There was some difficulty in finding means of broadcasting the government's capitulation to the Danish troops, because the local radio stations were not yet on the air at such an early hour. This was solved by broadcasting it on the Danish wavelength over the transmitter which the German battalion had brought along with it, and for which General Himer had thoughtfully dug up a truck to haul it to the citadel. At 2 o'clock that afternoon, General Himer, accompanied by the German minister, Cecil von Rentefink, called on the King of Denmark, who was no longer sovereign but did not yet realize it. Himer left a record of the interview in the Secret Army archives. The 70-year-old king appeared inwardly shattered, although he preserved outward appearances perfectly and maintained absolute dignity during the audience. His whole body trembled. He declared that he and his government would do everything possible to keep peace and order in the country, and to eliminate any friction between the German troops and the country. He wished to spare his country further misfortune and misery. General Himer replied that personally he very much regretted coming to the king on such a mission, but that he was only doing his duty as a soldier. We came as friends, etc. When the king then asked whether he might keep his bodyguard, General Himer replied that the Führer would doubtless permit him to retain them. He had no doubt about it. The king was visibly relieved at hearing this. During the course of the audience, the king became more at ease, and at its conclusion addressed General Himer with the words, "General, may I, as an old soldier, tell you something, as soldier to soldier? You Germans have done the incredible again. One must admit that it is magnificent work." For nearly 4 years, until the tide of war had changed, the Danish king and his people, a good-natured, civilized, and happy-go-lucky race, offered very little trouble to the Germans. Denmark became known as the Model Protectorate. The monarch, the government, the courts, even the parliament and the press, were at first allowed a surprising amount of freedom by their conquerors. Not even Denmark's 7,000 Jews were molested, for a time. But the Danes, later than most of the other conquered peoples, finally came to the realization that further loyal cooperation, as they called it, with their Teutonic tyrants, whose brutality increased with the years and with the worsening fortunes of war, was impossible, if they were to retain any shred of self-respect and honor. They also began to see that Germany might not win the war after all, and that little Denmark was not inexorably condemned, as so many had feared at first, to be a vassal state in Hitler's unspeakable new order. Then resistance began. The Norwegians resist. It began in Norway from the outset, though certainly not everywhere. At Narvik, the port and railhead of the iron ore line from Sweden, Colonel Conrad Sundlo, in command of the local garrison, who, as we have seen, was a fanatical follower of Quisling, surrendered to the Germans without firing a shot. The naval commander was of a different caliber. With the approach of 10 German destroyers at the mouth of the Long Fjord, the Eidsvoll, one of two ancient ironclads in the harbor, fired a warning shot and signaled to the destroyers to identify themselves. Rear Admiral Fritz Bonte, commanding the German destroyer flotilla, answered by sending an officer in a launch to the Norwegian vessel to demand surrender. There now followed a bit of German treachery, though German naval officers later defended it with the argument that in war necessity knows no law. When the officer in the launch signaled the German admiral that the Norwegians had said they would resist, Bonte waited only until his launch got out of the way, and then quickly blew up the Eidsvoll with torpedoes. The second Norwegian ironclad, the Norge, then opened fire but was quickly dispatched. 300 Norwegian sailors, almost the entire crews of the two vessels, perished. By 8 a.m. Narvik was in the hands of the Germans, taken by 10 destroyers which had slipped through a formidable British fleet, and occupied by a mere 2 battalions of Nazi troops under the command of Brigadier General Edvard Dietl, an old Bavarian crony of Hitler since the days of the Beer Hall Putsch, who was to prove himself a resourceful and courageous commander when the going at Narvik got rough, as it did beginning the next day. Trondheim, halfway down the long Norwegian west coast, was taken by the Germans almost as easily. The harbor batteries failed to fire on the German naval ships, led by the heavy cruiser Hipper, as they came up the long fjord, and the troops aboard that ship and 4 destroyers were conveniently disembarked at the city's piers without interference. Some forts held out for a few hours, and the nearby airfield at Værnes for 2 days, but this resistance did not affect the occupation of a fine harbor suitable for the largest naval ships as well as submarines, and the railhead of a line that ran across north-central Norway to Sweden, and over which the Germans expected, and with reason, to receive supplies, should the British cut them off at sea. Bergen, the second port and city of Norway, lying some 300 miles down the coast from Trondheim and connected with Oslo, the capital, by railway, put up some resistance. The batteries guarding the harbor badly damaged the cruiser Königsberg and an auxiliary ship, but troops from other vessels landed safely and occupied the city before noon. It was at Bergen that the first direct British aid for the stunned Norwegians arrived. In the afternoon, 15 naval dive bombers sank the Königsberg, the first ship of that size ever to go down as the result of an air attack. Outside the harbor, the British had a powerful fleet of 4 cruisers and 7 destroyers, which could have overwhelmed the smaller German naval force. It was about to enter the harbor when it received orders from the Admiralty to cancel the attack, because of the risk of mines and bombing from the air, a decision which Churchill, who concurred in it, later regretted. This was the first sign of caution and of half-measures which would cost the British dearly in the next crucial days. Sola Airfield, near the port of Stavanger on the southwest coast, was taken by German parachute troops after the Norwegian machine gun emplacements, there was no real anti-aircraft protection, were silenced. This was Norway's biggest airfield and strategically of the highest importance to the Luftwaffe, since from here bombers could range not only against the British fleet along the Norwegian coast, but against the chief British naval bases in northern Britain. Its seizure gave the Germans immediate air superiority in Norway and spelled the doom of any attempt by the British to land sizable forces. Kristiansand on the south coast put up considerable resistance to the Germans, its shore batteries twice driving off a German fleet led by the light cruiser Karlsruhe. But the forts were quickly reduced by Luftwaffe bombing and the port was occupied by mid-afternoon. The Karlsruhe, however, on leaving port that evening, was torpedoed by a British submarine and so badly damaged that it had to be sunk. By noon, then, or shortly afterward, the 5 principal Norwegian cities and ports and the 1 big airfield along the west and south coasts that ran for 1,500 miles from the Skagerrak to the Arctic were in German hands. They had been taken by a handful of troops conveyed by a navy vastly inferior to that of the British. Daring, deceit, and surprise had brought Hitler a resounding victory at very little cost. But at Oslo, the main prize, his military force and his diplomacy, had run into unexpected trouble. All through the chilly night of April 8th to 9th, a gay welcoming party from the German legation, led by Captain Schreiber, the naval attaché, and joined occasionally by the busy Dr. Breuer, the minister, stood at the quayside in Oslo Harbor waiting for the arrival of a German fleet and troop transports. A junior German naval attaché was darting about the bay in a motorboat waiting to act as pilot for the fleet, headed by the pocket battleship Lützow. Its name changed from Deutschland because Hitler did not want to risk losing a ship by that name. And the brand-new heavy cruiser Blücher, flagship of the squadron. They waited in vain. The big ships never arrived. They had been challenged at the entrance to the 50-mile-long Oslo Fjord by the Norwegian mine layer Olaf Trygvesen, which sank a German torpedo boat and damaged the light cruiser Emden. After landing a small force to subdue the shore batteries, the German squadron, however, continued on its way up the fjord. At a point some 15 miles south of Oslo, where the waters narrowed to 15 miles, further trouble developed. Here stood the ancient fortress of Oskersborg, whose defenders were more alert than the Germans suspected. Just before dawn, the fort's 28-centimeter Krupp guns opened fire on the Lützow and the Blücher, and torpedoes were also launched from the shore. The 10,000-ton Blücher, ablaze and torn by the explosions of its ammunition, went down, with the loss of 1,600 men, including several Gestapo and administrative officials, and all their papers, who were to arrest the king and the government and take over the administration of the capital. The Lützow was also damaged, but not completely disabled. Rear Admiral Oskar Kumitz, commander of the squadron, and General Erwin Engelbrecht, who led the 163rd Infantry Division, who were on the Blücher, managed to swim ashore, where they were made prisoners by the Norwegians, whereupon the crippled German fleet turned back for the moment to lick its wounds. It had failed in its mission to take the main German objective, the capital of Norway. It did not get there until the next day. Oslo, in fact, fell to little more than a phantom German force dropped from the air at the local undefended airport. The catastrophic news from the other seaports and the pounding of the guns 15 miles down the Oslo Fjord had sent the Norwegian royal family, the government, and members of parliament scurrying on a special train from the capital at 9:30 a.m. for Hamar, 80 miles to the north. 20 motor trucks laden with the gold of the Bank of Norway and 3 more with the secret papers of the Foreign Office got away at the same hour. Thus, the gallant action of the garrison at Oskersborg had foiled Hitler's plans to get his hands on the Norwegian king, government, and gold. But Oslo was left in complete bewilderment. There were some Norwegian troops there, but they were not put into a state for defense. Above all, nothing was done to block the airport at nearby Fornebu, which could have been done with a few old automobiles parked along the runway and about the field. Late on the previous night, Captain Spiller, the German air attaché in Oslo, had stationed himself there to welcome the airborne troops, which were to come in after the Navy had reached the city. When the ships failed to arrive, a frantic radio message was sent from the legation to Berlin, apprising it of the unexpected and unhappy situation. The response was immediate. Soon, parachute and airborne infantry troops were being landed at Fornebu. By noon, about 5 companies had been assembled. As they were only lightly armed, the available Norwegian troops in the capital could have easily destroyed them. But for reasons never yet made clear, so great was the confusion in Oslo, they were not mustered, much less deployed, and the token German infantry force marched into the capital behind a blaring, if makeshift, military band. Thus the last of Norway's cities fell. But not Norway. Not yet. On the afternoon of April 9th, the Storting, the Norwegian parliament, met at Hamar with only 5 of the 200 members missing, but adjourned at 7:30 p.m. when news was received that German troops were approaching and moved on to Elverum, a few miles to the east toward the Swedish border. Dr. Breuer, pressed by Ribbentrop, was demanding an immediate audience with the king, and the Norwegian Prime Minister had assented on condition that German troops withdraw to a safe distance south. This the German minister would not agree to. Indeed, at this moment a further piece of Nazi treachery was in the making. Captain Spiller, the air attaché, had set out from the Fornebu airport for Hamar with two companies of German parachutists to capture the recalcitrant king and government. It seemed to them more of a lark than anything else, since Norwegian troops had not fired a shot to prevent the German entry into Oslo. Spiller expected no resistance at Hamar. In fact, the two companies, traveling on commandeered autobuses, were making a pleasant sightseeing jaunt of it. But they did not reckon with a Norwegian army officer who acted quite unlike so many of the others. Colonel Ruge, Inspector General of Infantry, who had accompanied the king northward, had insisted on providing some sort of protection to the fugitive government, and had set up a roadblock near Hamar with two battalions of infantry, which he had hastily rounded up. The German buses were stopped, and in a skirmish which followed, Spiller was mortally wounded. After suffering further casualties, the Germans fell back all the way to Oslo. The next day, Dr. Breuer set out from Oslo alone along the same road to see the king. An old-school professional diplomat, the German minister did not relish his role, but Ribbentrop had kept after him relentlessly to talk the king and the government into surrender. Breuer's difficult task had been further complicated by certain political events which had just taken place in Oslo. On the preceding evening, Quisling had finally bestirred himself, once the capital was firmly in German hands, stormed into the radio station, and broadcast a proclamation naming himself as head of a new government, and ordering all Norwegian resistance to the Germans to halt immediately. Though Breuer could not yet grasp it, and Berlin could never, even later, understand it, this treasonable act doomed the German efforts to induce Norway to surrender. And paradoxically, though it was a moment of national shame for the Norwegian people, the treason of Quisling rallied the stunned Norwegians to a resistance which was to become formidable and heroic. Dr. Breuer met Håkon VII, the only king in the 20th century who had been elected to the throne by popular vote, and the first monarch Norway had had of its own for five centuries, in a schoolhouse at the little town of Elverum at 3 p.m. on April 10th. Norway had been a part of Denmark for four centuries and of Sweden for a further century, regaining its complete independence only in 1905, when it broke away from its union with Sweden and the people elected Prince Karl of Denmark as King of Norway. He assumed the name of Håkon VII. Håkon VI had died in 1380. Håkon VII was a brother of Christian X of Denmark, who surrendered so promptly to the Germans on the morning of April 9, 1940. From a talk this writer later had with the monarch and from a perusal of both the Norwegian records and Dr. Breuer's secret report, which is among the captured German Foreign Office documents, it is possible to give an account of what happened. After considerable reluctance, the king had agreed to receive the German envoy in the presence of his foreign minister, Dr. Halvdan Koht. When Breuer insisted on seeing Håkon at first alone, the king, with the agreement of Koch, finally consented. The German minister, acting on instructions, alternately flattered and tried to intimidate the king. Germany wanted to preserve the dynasty. It was merely asking Håkon to do what his brother had done the day before in Copenhagen. It was folly to resist the Wehrmacht. Only useless slaughter for the Norwegians would ensue. The king was asked to approve the government of Quisling and return to Oslo. Håkon, a salty, democratic man and a great stickler, even at this disastrous moment for constitutional procedure, tried to explain to the German diplomat that in Norway the king did not make political decisions. That was exclusively the business of the government, which he would now consult. Koht then joined the conversation, and it was agreed that the government's answer would be telephoned to Breuer at some point on his way back to Oslo. For Håkon, who, though he could not make the political decision, could surely influence it, there was but one answer to the Germans. Retiring to a modest inn in the village of Nibersund, near Elverum, just in case the Germans, with Breuer gone, tried to capture him in another surprise attack, he assembled the members of the government as Council of State. "For my part," he told them, "I cannot accept the German demands. It would conflict with all that I have considered to be my duty as King of Norway since I came to this country nearly 35 years ago. I do not want the decision of the government to be influenced by or based upon this statement. But I cannot appoint Quisling Prime Minister, a man in whom I know neither our people nor its representatives in the Storting have any confidence at all." If, therefore, the government should decide to accept the German demands, and I fully understand the reasons in favor of it, considering the impending danger of war, in which so many young Norwegians will have to give their lives, if so, abdication will be the only course open to me. The government, though there may have been some waverers up to this moment, could not be less courageous than the king, and it quickly rallied behind him. By the time Breuer got to Eidsvoll, halfway back to Oslo, Coate was on the telephone line to him with the Norwegian reply. The German minister telephoned it immediately to the legation in Oslo, where it was sped to Berlin. The king will name no government headed by Quisling, and this decision was made upon the unanimous advice of the government. To my specific question, Foreign Minister Coate replied, resistance will continue as long as possible. That evening, from a feeble little rural radio station nearby, the only means of communication to the outside world available, the Norwegian government flung down the gauntlet to the mighty Third Reich. It announced its decision not to accept the German demands and called upon the people, there were only 3 million of them, to resist the invaders. The king formally associated himself with the appeal. But the Nazi conquerors could not quite bring themselves to believe that the Norwegians meant what they said. 2 more attempts were made to dissuade the king. On the morning of April 11th, an emissary of Quisling, a Captain Irgens, arrived to urge the monarch to return to the capital. He promised that Quisling would serve him loyally. His proposal was dismissed with silent contempt. In the afternoon, an urgent message came from Breuer, requesting a further audience with the king to talk over certain proposals. The hard-pressed German envoy had been instructed by Ribbentrop to tell the monarch that he wanted to give the Norwegian people one last chance of a reasonable agreement. There is an ominous hint of further treachery in Ribbentrop's secret instructions. Breuer was told to try to arrange the meeting at a point between Oslo and the king's present place of residence. For obvious reasons, he, Breuer, would have to discuss this move fully with General von Falkenhorst, and would then also have to inform the latter of the meeting place agreed upon. Gauss, who telephoned Ribbentrop's instructions, reported that Herr Breuer clearly understood the meaning of the instructions. One cannot help but think that had the king gone to this meeting, Falkenhorst's troops would have grabbed him. This time, Dr. Coate, after consulting the king, replied that if the German minister had certain proposals, he could communicate them to the foreign minister. The Nazi reaction to this rebuff by such a small and now helpless country was immediate and in character. The Germans had failed, first to capture the king and the members of the government, and then to persuade them to surrender. Now the Germans tried to kill them. Late on April 11th, the Luftwaffe was sent out to give the village of Nieberschand the full treatment. The Nazi flyers demolished it with explosive and incendiary bombs and then machine-gunned those who tried to escape the burning ruins. The Germans apparently believed at first that they had succeeded in massacring the king and the members of the government. The diary of a German airman, later captured in northern Norway, had this entry for April 11th. Nieberschand, Oslo Regierung, alles vernichtet. Oslo government, completely wiped out. The village had been, but not the king and the government. With the approach of the Nazi bombers, they had taken refuge in a nearby wood. Standing in snow up to their knees, they had watched the Luftwaffe reduce the modest cottages of the hamlet to ruins. They now faced a choice of either moving on to the nearby Swedish border and asylum in neutral Sweden, or pushing north into their own mountains, still deep in the spring snow. They decided to move on up the rugged Gudbrands Valley, which led past Hamar and Lillehammer, and through the mountains to Andalsnes, on the northwest coast, 100 miles southwest of Trondheim. Along the route they might organize the still dazed and scattered Norwegian forces for further resistance. And there was some hope that British troops might eventually arrive to help them. The Battles for Norway. In the far north at Narvik, the British Navy had already reacted sharply to the surprise German occupation. It had been, as Churchill, who was in charge of it, admitted, completely outwitted by the Germans. Now, in the north at least, out of range of the German land-based bombers, it went over to the offensive. On the morning of April 10th, 24 hours after 10 German destroyers had taken Narvik and disembarked Dietl's troops, A force of 5 British destroyers entered Narvik Harbor, sank 2 of the 5 German destroyers then in the port, damaged the other 3, and sank all the German cargo vessels except 1. In this action, the German naval commander, Rear Admiral Bonta, was killed. On leaving the harbor, however, the British ships ran into the 5 remaining German destroyers emerging from nearby fjords. The German craft were heavier gunned and sank 1 British destroyer, forced the beaching of another on which the British commander, Captain Warburton Lee, was mortally wounded, and damaged a 3rd. 3 of the 5 British destroyers managed to make the open sea, where, in retiring, they sank a large German freighter laden with ammunition which was approaching the port. At noon on April 13th, the British, this time with the battleship Warspite, a survivor of the First World War Battle of Jutland, leading a flotilla of destroyers, returned to Narvik and wiped out the remaining German war vessels. Vice Admiral W. J. Whitworth, the commanding officer, in wirelessing the admiralty of his action, urged that since the German troops on shore had been stunned and disorganized, Dietl and his men had in fact taken to the hills, Narvik be occupied at once by the main landing force. Unfortunately for the Allies, the British Army commander, Major General P.J. Maxey, was an exceedingly cautious officer, and arriving the very next day with an advance contingent of 3 infantry battalions, decided not to risk a landing at Narvik but to disembark his troops at Harstad, 35 miles to the north, which was in the hands of the Norwegians. This was a costly error. In the light of the fact that they had prepared a small expeditionary corps for Norway, the British were unaccountably slow in getting their troops underway. On the afternoon of April 8th, after news was received of the movement of German fleet units up the Norwegian coast, the British Navy hurriedly disembarked the troops that had already been loaded on shipboard for the possible occupation of Stavanger, Bergen, Trondheim, and Narvik, on the ground that every ship would be needed for naval action. By the time the British land forces were re-embarked, all those port cities were in German hands, and by the time they reached central Norway they were doomed, as were the British naval ships which were to cover them, by the Luftwaffe's control of the air. By April 20th, 1 British brigade, reinforced by 3 battalions of French chasseurs alpins, had been landed at Namsos, a small port 80 miles northeast of Trondheim, and a 2nd British brigade had been put ashore at Andalsnes, 100 miles to the southwest of Trondheim, which was thus to be attacked from north and south. But lacking field artillery, anti-aircraft guns, and air support, their bases pounded night and day by German bombers which blocked the further landing of supplies or reinforcements, neither force ever seriously threatened Trondheim. The Andalsnes Brigade, after meeting a Norwegian unit at Donbas, a rail junction 60 miles to the east, abandoned the proposed attack northward toward Trondheim and pushed southeast down the Gudbrandsdal in order to aid the Norwegian troops, which, under the energetic command of Colonel Ruge, had been slowing up the main German drive coming up the valley from Oslo. At Lillehammer, north of Hamar, the first engagement of the war between British and German troops took place on April 21st, but it was no match. The ship laden with the British brigade's artillery had been sunk, and there were only rifles and machine guns with which to oppose a strong German force armed with artillery and light tanks. Even worse, the British infantry, lacking air support, was incessantly pounded by Luftwaffe planes operating from nearby Norwegian airfields. Lillehammer fell after a 24-hour battle, and the British and Norwegian forces began a retreat of 140 miles up the Valley Railway to Andalsnes, halting here and there to fight a rearguard action which slowed the Germans but never stopped them. On the nights of April 30th and May 1st, the British forces were evacuated from Andalsnes, and on May 2nd the Anglo-French contingent from Namsos. Considerable feats in themselves, for both harbors were blazing shambles from continuous German bombing. On the night of April 29th, the King of Norway and the members of his government were taken aboard the British cruiser Glasgow at Molde, across the Romsdal Fjord from Andalsnes, itself also a shambles from Luftwaffe bombing, and conveyed to Tromsø, far above the Arctic Circle and north of Narvik, where on May Day the provisional capital was set up. By then, the southern half of Norway, comprising all the cities and main towns, had been irretrievably lost. But northern Norway seemed secure. On May 28th, an Allied force of 25,000 men, including two brigades of Norwegians, a brigade of Poles, and two battalions of the French Foreign Legion, had driven the greatly outnumbered Germans out of Narvik. There seemed no reason to doubt that Hitler would be deprived of both his iron ore and his objective of occupying all of Norway and making the Norwegian government capitulate. But by this time, the Wehrmacht had struck with stunning force on the Western Front, and every Allied soldier was needed to plug the gap. Narvik was abandoned, the Allied troops were hastily re-embarked, and General Dietl, who had held out in a wild mountainous tract near the Swedish border, reoccupied the port on June 8th, and 4 days later accepted the surrender of the persevering and gallant Colonel Ruge and his bewildered, resentful Norwegian troops, who felt they had been left in the lurch by the British. King Haakon and his government were taken aboard the cruiser Devonshire at Tromsø on June 7th and departed for London and 5 years of bitter exile. In Berlin, Dietl was promoted to Major General, awarded the Ritterkreuz, and hailed by Hitler as the Sieger von Narvik. Quisling did not last long in his first attempt to govern Norway. 6 days after he had proclaimed himself Prime Minister, on April 15th, the Germans kicked him out and appointed an administrative council of 6 leading Norwegian citizens, including Bishop Eivind Berggrav, head of the Lutheran Church of Norway, and Paul Berg, the president of the Supreme Court. It was mostly the doing of Berg, an eminent and scrappy jurist who later became the secret head of the Norwegian resistance movement. On April 24th, Hitler appointed Josef Terboven, a tough young Nazi Gauleiter, to be Reich Commissar for Norway, and it was he who actually governed the country with increasing brutality during the occupation. Breuer, who had opposed Quisling from the beginning, was recalled on April 17th, retired from the diplomatic service, and sent to the Western Front as a soldier. The Germans reinstated Quisling as Prime Minister in 1942, but though his unpopularity among the people was immense, his power was nil despite his best efforts to serve his German masters. At the end of the war, Quisling was tried for treason and, after an exhaustive trial, sentenced to death and executed on October 24, 1945. Terboven committed suicide rather than face capture. Knut Hamsun, the great Norwegian novelist who had openly collaborated with the Germans, singing their praises, was indicted for treason, but the charges were dropped on the grounds of his old age and senility. He was, however, tried and convicted for profiting from the Nazi regime and fined $65,000. He died on February 19, 1952, at the age of 93. General von Falkenhorst was tried as a war criminal before a mixed British and Norwegian military court on charges of having handed over captured Allied commandos to the SS for execution. He was sentenced to death on August 2, 1946, but the sentence was commuted to life imprisonment. Despite his amazing successes, the Führer had had his bad moments during the Norwegian campaign. General Jodl's diary is crammed with terse entries recounting a succession of the warlord's nervous crises. "Terrible excitement," he noted on April 14th, after news had been received of the wiping out of the German naval forces at Narvik. On April 17th, Hitler had a fit of hysteria about the loss of Narvik. He demanded that General Dietl's troops there be evacuated by air, an impossibility. "Each piece of bad news," Jodl scribbled that day in his diary, "leads to the worst fears." And 2 days later, "Renewed crisis. Political action has failed. Envoy Breuer is recalled. According to the Führer, force has to be used." On April 13th, General von Falkenhorst, no doubt goaded by Hitler, who was in a fury because of Norwegian resistance, signed an order providing for taking as hostages 20 of the most distinguished citizens of Oslo, including Bishop Berggrav and Paul Berg, who, in the words of Minister Breuer, were to be shot in the event of the continued resistance or attempted sabotage. The conferences at the Chancellery in Berlin that day, April 19th, became so embittered, with the heads of the three services blaming each other for the delays, that even the lackey Keitel stalked out of the room. "Chaos of leadership is again threatening," Jodl noted. And on April 22nd he added, "Führer is increasingly worried about the English landings." On April 23rd, the slow progress of the German forces moving up from Oslo toward Trondheim and Andalsnes caused the excitement to grow, as Jodl put it. But the next day the news was better, and from that day it continued to grow more rosy. By the 26th, the warlord was in such fine fettle that at 3:30 in the morning, during an all-night session with his military advisers, he told them he intended to start Yellow between May 1st and 7th. Yellow was the code name for the attack in the west across Holland and Belgium. Though on April 29th Hitler was again worried about Trondheim, the next